You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Preparing for today, I ran across Frederick Buechner's thoughts on this story, and they're so good. I'm just going to share his observations as context for today's reading. Absalom was one of King David's many sons, and almost from the start, he had a number of strikes against him. For one thing, Buechner says, he was much too handsome for his own good, and his special pride was such a magnificent head of hair that once a year, when he had it trimmed, the trimmings alone allegedly tipped the scales at 3.5 pounds. For another thing, his father, King David, was always either spoiling him rotten or reading him the Riot Act. And this didn't promote stability of character. Absalom murdered his lecherous brother Amnon for fooling around with their sister Tamar. And when his cousin, the old war horse Joab, wouldn't help him patch things up with David afterward, Absalom set fire to Joab's hayfields. But this kind of daring do was seen as irresistible by many in Israel. And so when Absalom eventually led a revolt against his father, a lot of his fan base joined up as rebels. On the eve of what was to be the crucial showdown battle, David was a wreck. If he was afraid he might lose his throne, he was even more afraid that he might lose Absalom. The boy was a thorn in his flesh, but he was also the apple of his eye. And before the fighting started, he told his chiefs of staff, till they were sick of hearing it, that if Absalom fell into their clutches, they must promise to go easy on him for his father's sake. Remembering what had happened to his hayfield, old Joab kept his fingers crossed that he would be the one to find Absalom. So when Joab did indeed find Absalom, caught in the branches of an oak tree, by his beautiful hair no less, well, you'll get the picture. Joab then sends a Cushite to deliver the news to David. Now, while it's unclear exactly where Cush was, the biblical understanding is that a Cushite would have been a dark-skinned foreigner from what would now be Ethiopia or Sudan. In other words, Joab, who, remember, is David's nephew, adds insult to injury by sending the news of Absalom's death via an outsider who doesn't know the players or the details of the situation, virtually guaranteeing that the breaking of the news to the king is done in the most cruel and heartless way imaginable, by no fault of the messenger.
Our words of wisdom today are from 2 Samuel chapter 18, verses 9 through 15, verse 21, and verses 31 through 33. Absalom ran into David's men, but was out in front of them riding his mule. When the mule ran under the branches of a huge oak tree, Absalom's head was caught in the oak, and he was left hanging, dangling between heaven and earth, the mule running right out from under him. A solitary soldier saw him and reported it to Joab.
"I just saw Absalom hanging from an oak tree."
Joab said to the man who told him,
"If you saw him, why didn't you kill him then and there? I have rewarded you with 10 pieces of silver and a fancy belt."
The man told Joab,
"Even if I had a chance at 1,000 pieces of silver, I wouldn't have laid a hand on the king's son. We all heard the king command you and Abishai and Ittai, for my sake, protect the young man Absalom. Why, I've been risking my life, for nothing is hidden from the king, and you would have just stood there."
Joab said,
"I can't waste my time with you."
He then grabbed 3 knives and stabbed Absalom in the heart while he was still alive in the tree. By then, Absalom was surrounded by 10 of Joab's armor bearers. They hacked away at him and killed him. Then Joab ordered a Cushite.
You go tell the king what you have seen.
Yes, sir, said the Cushite, and ran off. Then the Cushite arrived and said,
good news, my master and king. God has given victory today over all those who rebelled against you.
But, said the king, is the young man Absalom all right?
And the Cushite replied, with that all of your enemies of my master the king and all who maliciously rose against you end up like that young man.
The king was stunned, heartbroken. He went up to the room over the gate and wept. And he wept and cried out, oh, my son Absalom, my dear, dear son Absalom, why not me rather than you? My death, not yours. Oh, Absalom, my dear, dear son. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
One day, Mullah Nasruddin's son asked him, Father, which is more useful, the sun or the moon? The mullah replied, my son, of course, the moon is more useful. It provides us light at night when it is dark. The sun, alas, shines during the day when it is already light. Now, that's some clever thinking. But you know what? We all do it, don't we? We all interpret parts of our lives in ways that anyone else can look at and say, seriously? For our final look at some life lessons from King David, and I'm returning to Lewis Smead's book, A Pretty Good Person, and embracing an idea that Smead puts this way. Think of yourself as someone who is writing a story out of the bits and pieces of your life. You are both the author and the main character, and you are here on earth to try and write an honest story, a continuing story, not an unconnected collection of episodes, but a real story about a real person who somehow stays in one piece, inside and out, all the way to the end. The first thing we have to do is to own the story we were given to write. I am my story. And what comes of my story is up to me. Mine to take credit for, to take blame for, mine to own up to. Some parts we can't control, but still need to own up to, like the raw material, the genetic cards we were dealt, the family we were raised in, the culture and time that have socialized us. We have to own our own wounds and brokenness, our losses, and our sufferings as part of what makes us who we are. And we have to own our ogres. I love Gore Vidal's brutal honesty in writing, every time my friends succeed, I die a little. That envy is an ogre. Maybe you have a few ogres on a leash. Hypocrisy, self-righteousness, lust, prudishness, stinginess. Finally, we all have bad chapters that we have to own. Dear old King David had a whole string of them, many brought on by his own failure to own up to his ogres, his wounds, and the impact his choices or failure to make choices were making on the lives of those around him. Most of the time, we're satisfied with interpreting events in ways that help us feel better about ourselves. Like the man who married a widow after his spouse had died. Things did not go at all smoothly. All he did was constantly talk about his former wife, and all the woman did was constantly talk about her dead husband. One night, lying in bed, they began to talk about their former spouses again, when suddenly the man just shoved his wife off the bed. The woman shrieked and was so upset that she called the police, who immediately came to investigate. One of the officers asked the man why he had pushed the woman off the bed. He said, believe me, officer, it wasn't my fault. Counting both my former wife and her deceased husband, There were four of us in that bed, and there just wasn't enough room. She just fell off. So, if you're honest, what kind of rewrite are you engaged in? Not all of us can be like King David, who, even despite all his stupid decisions and actions, came out smelling like a rose. Why? He had a great marketing department. But even after today's episode, when David was arguably at one of the lowest ebbs of his life and kingship, and more trouble, betrayal, and struggle was on the horizon, a funny thing happened in the midst of it all. David pressed on. Despite traitors, famines, and his own ego. And by the time we get to chapter 22, David is writing a song singing the praises of God for having seen him through it all. And how'd he do that? He was honest. He didn't hold back acknowledging all the crap that he'd endured, both the hand he was dealt by others and the self-inflicted wounds. All of it together made up who he was. And he says, yep, God, you were there through it all. Lewis Smedes says, having a story to write is why we were born. We have to own it, take responsibility for it, and claim it all as ours, the bad and good, in the sure knowledge that we are always free to write new chapters in the time we have. But you know, there are a lot of Christians who don't believe we're free to write new chapters. They come at it from a completely different place theologically. I hear it from well-intentioned people who are going through tough times. Oh, I must not be in God's will. That's why I'm suffering. That kind of thinking is all fine and good if you're talking about the consequences of having lied or cheated or fill in the blank. But when someone says, God has my life all planned out, and it's my job to figure out what decisions to make to be on that track. If things are going well, I can say, what a good boy I am. God loves me. But if I get off track, then I'll suffer punishment from God. Again, I say, oh, please. Jesus had to debunk this kind of thing all the time. Remember when people came to him and asked him things like, what did this or that person do to deserve this punishment? Blindness, leprosy, whatever. Jesus usually didn't even try to correct their cause and effect thinking. He just touched the person and healed the person, essentially starting a new chapter for their lives. Many of you are familiar with what's called process theology. It has roots at Claremont School of Theology, which up until this year was in Los Angeles, and a lot of clergy in this conference studied there. Super simplified, process theology basically says that the divine is in process with us. There is no plan. The ground of being, the spirit of life, whatever you call the mystery of God, is just as surprised as we are at the capacity for human beings to be inhumane to one another. Despite what I've heard some people say, the Holocaust was not a punishment of God upon a whole people. The Holocaust was a horrific act perpetrated on human beings by human beings. We take that story, we tell that story, and we have a couple of choices. We can either be crushed by the horror of it, or we can be vigilant to make sure it never happens again, using the story itself to begin writing a new chapter. Corrie ten Boom was a Dutch Christian who, with her family, helped Jews escape the Holocaust. For their efforts, they too were imprisoned. In her book, Tramp for the Lord, she tells the post-war story of being approached by a former concentration camp guard who had been known as one of the cruelest at the Ravensbrück camp. Reluctant to forgive him, she prayed that she would be able to do so. She wrote, "For a long moment, we grasped each other's hands, the former guard and the former prisoner. I had never known God's love so intensely as I did then." From her post-war experience with other victims of Nazi brutality, she observed that those who were able to forgive were best able to rebuild their lives. In the before time, before the pandemic and all the unrest of the last 9 months, it may have been a temptation to dismiss admonitions like, "Do not be afraid, do not be discouraged," as empty platitudes. But for many of us right here, right now, we need to hear those words loud and clear. Most of us don't need today's story to remind us that we live in a world where brokenness has a way of breeding even more brokenness, where we sometimes feel like we're losing our grip on any power to affect change in the reality of the troubles in our lives. But the first thing we need to remember is that it's not about assigning blame. Although many of the things we suffer through, we're also to blame for. And it's not about attributing bad chapters to God's punishment. It's about taking each moment, even the Absalom, Absalom, my dear son Absalom moments, and leveraging them to write new chapters. In 1913, Rabindranath Tagore, a Bengali poet, was the first non-European to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. He offers this prayer. "Let me not pray to be sheltered from dangers, but to be fearless in facing them. Let me not beg for the stilling of my pain, but for the heart to conquer it. Let me not look for allies in life's battlefield, but to my own strength. Let me not crave in anxious fear to be saved, but hope for the patience to win my freedom. Grant me that I may not be a coward, feeling your mercy in my success alone, but let me find the grasp of your hand in my failure." I think a good follow-on to those sentiments is from Paul in Philippians 2, where he writes, "Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who is at work in you, enabling you both to will and to work for God's good pleasure." Work it out. God is an incorrigible enabler. And as we go along, we all get banged up, beat down, and pushed back. But even in the Absalom, O Absalom moments, maybe especially in the Absalom, O Absalom moments, we are enabled to write chapters that shine more light on who we really are than anything else. Which takes us to our stream of thought from that great theologian, Leonard Cohen, here channeling the poet Rumi. "Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." Owning our own stories means taking responsibility, but it also means not shying away from the worst chapters in our lives as something to be forgotten. They're a part of not only who we are, but part of what makes us sensitive enough to be with others who are enduring the same. Do you know where the English word sincere comes from? It's based on the Latin words sin, without, and cere, wax. Apparently, in ancient Rome, Wax was sometimes used on bronze sculptures to fill in imperfections and gloss over flaws. Sculptors who wanted their work to stand on its own merit without anything covering up any shortcomings would pronounce a work sincere, or without wax. The flaws and imperfections are a part of the beauty, the realness of the final product. To paraphrase George Bernard Shaw, instead of being a feverish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy, be used for a purpose, recognized as a mighty one. Be a force of nature. This is the true joy in life. Like King David, own your story. The ailments and grievances, the mistakes and the sorrows, the joys and the disappointments. And always remember, along the way, to ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.